What happened was that the islands were discovered. They were considered very valuable because of the schnapo, the sea otter. In 1745, the people did not know how to use the fur seal skins. They didn't know how to remove the guard hairs. And maybe 20 years later, I think the Chinese discovered how to prepare a fur seal. But the sea otter pelt was immediately valuable. When Captain Cook came here in 1778, and the men on his ship, they got some sea otter skins to sleep on, just to use for keeping warm and keeping their bedclothes clean. When they got to Canton, China, they found they were very valuable. And that, of course, is because the sea otter pelt was very easy to prepare, and it was quickly useful. So the Russians came then in larger numbers and larger numbers. And but never more than 1,000 at any one time. There weren't very many at any one time. And the Aleut term for a Russian was Cossack, a Kazaka. And then in 1824, Bishop Veniaminov appeared. He was not a bishop then, a priest, Innocenti Veniaminov. And let me remark here that Veniaminov, who built the church here, the Holy Ascension Church, was born in the same village as Academician of Plotnikov in Siberia. And Academician of Plotnikov is writing the life history of Veniaminov and hopes to get more information here. Then Innocenti, first it was John, then Innocenti, then Bishop, finally Metropolitan. But he went from priest to bishop in here somewhere. Veniaminov, to use the English Merikonsky dialect, moved into Unalaska and built a very fine church and then enlarged. And he set up a school. He did two things of special interest. Number one, he set up the church school so that people learned their catechisms, their kamagasin, and all that sort of thing. And the second thing is, he made the alphabet. And that gave the Aleuts a great deal of prestige and made them quite famous. So he set up this alphabet that we have been using here, and he published some books. He had the Unangam Tunum, and he had the Unangam Asmoka. And so everybody had to learn A, Ga, La, V, E, K, Ka, so forth, and they all did. And within 3 years of preparing this alphabet, first he had to make some special sounds, because in the Russian there is a ga, a gamma, a ra, but there is no ra, as in tatusim ro. So he put this hat on it, and the Aleuts call this a hat. It's a diacritic. So they had this gamma from the old Greek gamma, and then they just added the hat, which puts it back a little further, a ra. And they had the ka, everybody had a ka, but to indicate a ka, like a q, then they put this little cross on it there. And there was they had the sound o, but they didn't have any w, wo. So Innocenti Veniaminov put there on there, so he could say wa, wo, wo. That then was like a w. So he made something like eight new characters just by adding little hats, little crosses on the letters, on the sounds that they had on the Russian alphabet. So then it was more than a Cyrillic alphabet, it was an Aleut Cyrillic alphabet. The Aleuts had their own alphabet. So then they all started, for some reason we don't know, they started writing letters to each other. They got busy, they wrote diaries and they wrote letters. The Aleuts wrote more diaries and more letters than any other people in the world. And then, secondly, within 3 years of the preparation of the alphabet of Veniaminov, a man in Belkovsky wrote a book. and just appeared that the Aleuts had been waiting 8,700 years for an alphabet so they could start writing. So they became literate immediately and wrote letters and diaries, and then one man wrote a book. Now this is very important in for example, the matter of the land claims, to demonstrate the fact that they became civilized, they had the resident priests, their own language, and they could write it. And that's important, along with the archaeological evidence of how long they had been here, and the fact that only Aleuts had been here. Now there are enough skeletons that should be marked here to jump from the alphabet back to the skeletons, that only skeletons of Aleuts had been found in the old village Middens. There were no Indians, and there were no Eskimos, only Aleuts. So the Aleuts have been here a long period of time, and only Aleuts have been here a long period of time. Well, then the Russian system of education was set up, and they prepared books, and many of you have seen those books in which half the page is in Unamun. And half was in Russian. So they learned to read and write Russian at the same time they learned to read and write their own language. And these little book bars were used in the church, and then for the church services, and then for general purposes. So the people were trained in reading and writing and arithmetic, and they were trained to become clerks and business managers, and they got promoted. And they rose very high in the Russian-American company. So the coming of Bishop Bagminov was a very important event for the education, and there was no one else in North America had their own alphabet with which they could use. So we have a lot of documents preserved and a lot of information that would not otherwise have existed. Then we find that a lot of people around Bristol Bay, when the United States government, which was a little late in getting in here, started taking a census, and they would ask people if they were Aleuts, and the Eskimos would sign up as Aleuts. So there were 5,000 Aleuts signed up for the census, but only 3,000 Aleuts actually alive. So this has been a problem to sort out. Well, there are two or three other things that I want to remark on, and that is that in Leningrad there are some very fine collections. They are better than in our own National Museum. And they show two things. One is how the Aleuts were making boats and how they were making models. And a very interesting thing about Aleut culture is that the Aleuts, if they make something smaller, they make it correct, they make it right. So the large single hatch boat, which the Eskimo would call a kayak, and we use the Siberian term bidarki for it. And in Aleut is ikyala. That's the one that has one hatch. This is for the sea otter. The hatch is back here. Turns the boat. Now the interesting thing is the keel of this ikyala, this bidarki, is on the inside. Now therefore it's called a keelson. But the real point is it's made of three pieces. So they had a section here, and they had a cut here. And then they bound it together with baleen from the baleen whale. Now by having this keelson made of three pieces, it was much more flexible. And the Aleuts had to go out in sometimes in very hard seas. And if they were paddling for 8 hours, then the little boat took a great pounding. Any boat could survive 1 hour, but 8 hours, 16 hours, then you need to have a flexible keel or keelson. And for going over waves at a diagonal and meeting them head on boat, it takes a lot of torture and twisting. So, had these joints, and Bishop Bagminov noted that they jointed the keelson. And sometimes they put a piece of ivory in here where the two met. So So this would come up like this, and this member like this. You put a piece of bird bone or a piece of ivory in here. You burn it. And then a hole here, and a hole here, a hole here, a hole here, and bind it together. Well, you can still see these in Leningrad. When I went to Leningrad in 1964, and the lady who was helping me, showing me the collections, I said I would like to see the boats. See, the kayaks, the ikyaba, by Darkey, that the naval officers had brought back in 1806. She said, all right, well, we must go over to the Naval Museum. I thought that was very interesting. They had put the boats in the Naval Museum. But it was not because they were boats, it was because they were collected by naval officers. And there they are, just as they were in 1806. Nicely preserved. Then they had, secondly, and some of them had this two-piece keelson. And you could see it. And secondly, they had some little models, like Mr. Sergei Savarov still makes in Nikolsky, and like Andrew Snigarov and George Prokopyov used to make in Hatka. It's actual dimension models. And then the model, and the little one, they have the three-piece keelson. So the interesting thing is that the Aleuts were very good at relative relations of things. So they could draw a map of a harbor, the Russians found out, and it would be accurate. Things would be in the right relationship to each other. But when they made a model of a boat, they didn't make it small, they made it correct as well as small, and preserved all the details, such as the lashing. Well, this attention to detail, but the proportions is a very interesting characteristic of Aleut culture, and I think one that they have had to develop because of the difficult conditions of life in an area that's very rich, but takes a great deal of skill and patience, a lot of skill, in order to get the maximum out of it. And of course, the maximum has been the ability to survive for 8,700 years. So what we have here is the longest example of a single people living in one place and doing it successfully. Well, that's just a thumbnail sketch of some of the kinds of things that we've been working on. And I think that we're going to learn now much more about the recent history and about the early history as a consequence of being able to work directly with the people who have the other side of the Bering Sea. So I'm very delighted that you people have come. I'm certainly very proud of our government and of the arrangements that have been made for this excellent cooperation with the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And I think if you have questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Maybe our Russian colleagues can answer them better, but I think I will stop there.
Thank you, Dr. Lawson. Perhaps this gentleman, and I've forgotten your name, would like to talk about wanting to know about Dr. Veniaminov here. If you could translate.
Translate for you. Друзья очень заняты, у них мало времени, поэтому коротко скажу.
I know that our friends are very busy people, and I would say it in a short word.
Мне очень повезло в том смысле, что я учился в том самом селе, в котором родился Вениаминов.
I am a happy man because I was teaching in the same village where Father Вениаминов was born.
И должен сказать, что нас, Вениаминов, советских ученых тоже очень интересует.
And Soviet scientists are deeply interested in Bishop Vinyaminov activity.
В двух планах. С одной стороны, как ученый.
First of all, Vinyaminov as a scientist.
Ученый, который проник в самое существо, во-первых, языка is Aleut.
The scientist who understands the essence of Aleutian language.
И нужно сказать, что он сохранил для нас то, что вообще исчезло.
And gift us the same quality of that language of which no anywhere.
И не только
anywhere.
И не только язык.
And not only language.
Но и духовную культуру Aleut.
But and their spiritual culture.
Для нас всегда представляет большой интерес проникнуть вглубь веков.
It's a great interesting for us to look in the depth of centuries.
И очень легко понять материальную культуру.
And it's easier to understand the material culture of people.
Например, объекты, да? Жилища.
For example, the schools, buildings.
Но всего труднее понять мысли наших далеких предков.
But the most difficult is to understand the minds of our ancestors.
И вот богатейший материал для нас в этом смысле сохранил ли они?
And the richest material in this question gift us Bishop Veniaminov.
То есть религия.
Религия.
Своего рода философия.
Философия.
И, конечно, богатейшая духовная культура.
And of course richest ideal culture.
И можно сказать, когда читаешь Вениаминова, то испытываешь, чувствуешь уважение к этим древним жителям Алеутских островов.
And when I read the Bishop Veniaminov's book, I feel a deep respect to this ancient people of Aleutian Islands.
Вот я уже более почти 50 лет занимаюсь раскопками.
During 50 years I visited excavations.
От Монголии, скажем, до Тихого океана.
From Mongolia to Pacific Ocean.
И каждый раз, когда мы находим остатки древнего человека, хочется поговорить с ним.
And everyone, when we discovered,
услышать его слово.
And when we discover earlier men, I want to speak with him about his life, about the last times.
Но как это сделать?
But how to do it?
Так вот, живых людей каменного века мы можем, так сказать, услышать, поговорить с ними благодаря Вениаминову.
And we could speak with people of with the living people of stone age thanks to Bishop Veniaminov.
Это относится к истории.
It's about history.
Но не менее важно и другое, что Вениаминов был защитником Алеутов.
And very important another fact that Bishop Veniaminov was protector of Aleuts.
От насилия, от притеснений тогдашнего русского начальства.
That he protect Aleutian people from actions of Russian administration, of Russian bureaucracy that time.
И кроме того, Вениаминов помогал Алеутам создавать свою новую культуру. Он дал им какую-нибудь письменность.
And he assisted Aleutians to create their own culture. He gifted them alphabet
и так далее.
And so on.
И я вот с большим удовольствием побывал снова совсем недавно, в прошлом году, в этой моей родной деревне, где родился Вениаминов.
And I was great pleasure visiting last year that village where Bishop Veniaminov was born, and I was teaching.
И нашел в сохранности дом, в котором он родился.
And seen seen the house where Bishop Veniaminov was born in a good quality.
Да, и рассказал об этом своим землякам.
And said about it to my countrymen.
Которые обещали хранить этот дом.
Who said me that they would protect Bishop Veniaminov's house in the same quality in the future.
А последнее, что я хочу сказать, это то, что мне и моим друзьям удалось осуществить мечту.
And last, what I want to say, it's about a great happy for us to realize our old dream for me and my colleagues.
Вот когда я учился в школе, потом в университете, даже мысли у нас не было, что когда-нибудь удастся побывать в тех местах, где работал Вениаминов.
When I was teaching in the school and then in the university, we hadn't think that it would be possible to visit the place where Bishop Vinyaminov was working in which we lived.
И вот теперь это реальность.
And now it is reality.
Мы стоим на Алеутской земле.
We are staying on Aleutian land.
И за это я должен сказать спасибо, прежде всего, доктору Лаплину.
And I want to say a great thanks to Dr. Laplin.
Это только мне понятно, какую громадную энергию понадобилось развить для того, чтобы осуществить нашу совместную работу.
Only I could understand how many strength it was necessary to put in order to organize our common work, united work here.
Ну и кроме того, большое спасибо нашим хозяевам Холливудской корпорации, которые так тепло, так приветно принимают советских ученых, ну, с той стороны, с земли.
And a great thanks to Aleutian Corporation, which met us with such pleasure and gave us various kinds of protection to us guests from another side of the land.
И в моем лице, и в лице профессора Лаплина, я сказал бы, подают руки друг другу два великих народа. Русский народ и американский народ.
And in the person of Professor Laplin and in my person, we see how two great people, American and Soviet, made a fruitful cooperation.
Спасибо вам, что вы так тепло слушали внимательно профессора Лаплина. И наконец меня самого. Спасибо вам, Дэн.
And thanks a lot to you that you had a good, that you listened so good of Professor Laplin and myself.
Thank you very much. Would you like to ask questions of the gentleman here?
Seasonal, but over a period of 4,000 years, it averages out. But certainly during the winter, we collect a large number of sea urchins, and then this would change to bidarkies and other things after that. The salmon only came in the spring, so you might get a large layer of salmon bones, or halibut bones, or primarily for winter, fall and summer. So there's, fortunately, there's this very fine stratigraphy. So you can tell what belongs to which layer. And when you get a date, radiocarbon date, then you know that it covers a certain distance. But I think you've seen an essential characteristic, a very nice stratification because of the seasonal availability of foods.
The study they've done on Antarctica on the sea urchin and sea otter relationships out there has shown that the sea urchin is being degraded. And the otters are predating on them so heavily that when the sea urchins go down, they get smaller and smaller, so their food diet is decreased, which in fact is what's happened out there, and the otters are starving. And there's been two maps where the people were forced into smaller urchins.
Yes, and we have a model, we have a systems modeler working with us. We have two of them. And the interesting thing about this is, and that is that if you had only three animals, the three key animals in the Aleutians are the Aleuts,
and the otters, the sea otters, and the urchins. And in order to save the government money, we've been doing our systems analysis on these three forms. If you only had sea otters, see, nothing else in the world, the population would still oscillate. It would go back and forth. And if the world was only composed of urchins or otters, it would oscillate back and forth. And if the world was only composed of algae, it would oscillate back and forth. But as soon as you have, you introduce algae on top of these two, it dampens the oscillations, and they all do better.
That's an interesting point, because some of the marine mammalogists have felt that the current stock of marine mammals, for example, because of the protection, is greater than it has been in prehistoric times. And they feel very strongly that the primitive peoples in the area had kept those stocks down to a not quite in the, you know, in the absence of the curve, not in that high, in that high growth rate. And
yes, that's right. That's very interesting. I think that some predation will serve the effect of dampening the oscillations and maintaining the stability of the population. So the very interesting feature of the Aleutian marine economy was this unusual stability. It just was not very sensitive.
What relationship can be drawn, say, from the people that originally came from the land bridge, the Aleuts, to the Alaska coastal Indians, Tlingit Haida's, going down the British Columbia coast, Oregon, Washington, through Mexico, South America, whatnot? Is there any relationship in the peoples there?
Yes. And since I come originally from Oregon, I can speak to this with authority.
That's the reason I would say, a little south of Bend is a site called Shiprock that you're probably very familiar with.
I know, I worked out there.
They've dated things, 10,000 years?
Oh, yeah. But the Oregon, by the way, is the place where I learned to work in the rain, and that's how I got the job working for Dr. Edrich at the National Museum, as most other people from the East Coast didn't believe in standing out in the rain. I thought it was what everybody did. the land bridge was something like this. It's 1,000 miles across here, from there to there. And then it came down here to Fort Lauderdale, went out to Umnak, and then the islands with four mountains, and the Andreanoffs, and the Rats, and then the Near Islands, so forth. These big island clusters. And the thesis that I want to suggest, and I hope to convince by means of denying them food or making them eat peanut butter, I want to convince them. I think that what happened is that the ancestors of the Bering Sea Mongoloids, the Aleuts, came around the coast. They had this maritime economy. They knew how to make use of intertidal resources, and they knew how to make use of sea mammals and fish and birds. So they lived very well. You always get a higher population density on the coast than in the interior. Always. No exception anywhere in the world. Now, I think the ancestors of the American Indians, they went through the interior route. And maybe they were hunting mammoths and reindeer, caribou, and some brown sloths and some horses and so forth. And they went on down to the Columbia River, where they lived pretty high, went right through Oregon and learned how to live in the rain, down in California and got sunburned, and went down through Mexico and so forth. Now, there are three, basically, different kinds of people in the New World, Americans, all of them. And if you look at the blood groups, you can see how they're arranged. See, the blood groups of the Aleuts and the Eskimos have all three kinds. They've got blood type B, blood type A,
and blood type O. But the North American Indians, like the Piegans, the blood and the Blackfeet, or the Houstonate and the Salish and the Umpqua and so forth from Oregon, or Pawnee or Sioux or Cheyenne, whatever you want, they don't have any B. They've got lots of A, and they have lots of blood type O. And then you go down to South America, the South American Indians, they don't have any B, they don't have any A. They're 100% O. So, we can reason from this that there must have been at least three migrations. And that two of those migrations were Indians, the ones that went down to South America, who were 100% blood type O. The Indians who came into North America and stopped there, with mixing, of course, we're talking about minor population distinctions, not species. But when they had blood type A, some of them had large amounts, the Bloods, the Piegans and the Blackfeet of southern Canada, Alberta, and northern Montana had the highest A in the world, 78%. And then the third and the last group, maybe the last group to come, don't know whether it was the last or not, were the Aleuts and the Eskimos, maybe before they separated. I don't know if they were different. But they have blood type B, like the Buryats and the Kalmucks and the Tungus and the Asiatic people. So in some respects, genetically, just using very slight differences, they're more similar to the people of Asia than are the American Indians. One way to explain this is that the Indians went through the interior, whereas the Aleuts, ancestors of the Aleuts and the Eskimos, maybe the Chukchi as well, came along the coast. So what I want to propose is that the coast route was the main route, a road, and the Indians were in the interior, and they were 500 miles apart. So they didn't see each other very often. And when they did see each other, they were too tired to do anything about it. So, Angola, we have all these tools, hundreds and hundreds now, and statistically it's becoming very substantial. And they're all flaked on only one surface and on the edges. It's a unifacial industry. So, I have to notice, unifacial. And this is like some sites in Siberia, like Malta and others, where the only flake on one surface and on the other. But all of the interior sites, you see, of the Indians and others, they are bifacial. So we can call these the bifacial people if we want. So what it means is that there wasn't very much meeting, there wasn't very much contact. Otherwise, they probably would have learned to make some bifacial tools. So I think that the geographic distinction and distance between the interior people and the coast people has probably maintained the minor physical differences and the cultural differences. And then turning it around, the fact that these are all unifacial tools means that they didn't have any important contacts with people who had bifacial tools. I hope there's an answer to the question in there somewhere. Yes.
Would you put like the South American Indians on an earlier migration than the Aleuts and Eskimo, or do you feel that they were both there at the same time, right from the very beginning?
Well, first I should be honest, say we don't have enough evidence to know.
What's your theory?
No. But second, I would guess that the Indians may have come over earlier and gone on down to clear down to the tip of the Tierra del Fuego. And we just don't know about the about Umnak here and about the land bridge. Maybe the Aleuts and their ancestors came over only 15,000 years ago.
12,000. I don't know. It could have been just as early as the Indians. So what I have done is suggest that it's the geographical distance between the interior and the coast which kept them different, see, and not the time. But if they came over at different times, that would also keep them different. And it will probably take several years of research to find out whether it's the geographic difference or the earlier time of the Indians that kept them separate. But since they have sites down at Fell's Cave 10,000 years ago, maybe the Indians did get over earlier. Just don't know.
Is there evidence that they came during the interglacial period?
Yes. They come during an interglacial while it was dry.
And then an earlier interglacial period?
Probably. I don't know if they came that early. Mm-hmm. No hard evidence. Mm-hmm. During the last interglacial.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Was this a seasonal migration, or did they continue throughout the year, or just?
I think it was continuous. You see, that when the water levels were low, they were low during the glacial period.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had a lot of land surface with a lot of foliage on it. It was for grazing animals and so forth. So people could live on the land, although not too well. But if you like mammoth meat, then you could enjoy it, I guess.
All year round, that would be
that? All year round. We think they had to be there the year round. Probably small groups, 40 to 50 people. Well dispersed. But continuously living permanently on the Bering Land Bridge. They didn't know that they were on the move.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't aware of that. And they didn't know the sea level was rising.
What was the pattern of the sea migration? Was it small tribes also?
Yes, always. Small groups. You can't have big villages. Unalaska was the biggest village in the Aleutian chain when it was discovered. And it had over 300 people. It may have had 600. That's bigger than Point Barrow, it's bigger than Wainwright. This was an enormous settlement here, a permanent settlement. It was a beginning city then. But they were out on that land bridge as though it were going to be there forever. They didn't know it was a temporary affair. And anything that lasted 25,000 years, that's longer than our, it's longer than most things survive.
Do you think that your theory of this ecosystem, whatever you call it, can be presented to the wilderness people in contesting some of the litigation that's going on?
Absolutely, and it already has been.
Could you elaborate?
Yes, well, the two very able persons from the Division of Land of the Aleut Corporation, Larry McCulia and George Petnikoff, came down to Connecticut to discuss just this point. And I suggested something for an idea that I think they already had. But since we both said it, then we both believe it. I suggest that what they do is delay the wilderness proposal, which is premature in some respects, and that they have what you call an Aleut ecosystem. We call it Aleut, not Aleutian. Name it after the Aleuts, because it's the humans that define the area. Ecosystem. I think we call it research and management unit or division. And then that should have three divisions. And one is on the human population. And all the things dealing with the humans, the Aleuts, everything dealing with their growth. There aren't even growth standards haven't been even set up for the children yet. And tooth dimensions and all the rest. And then all the
services that go in here. And then another, I think, was prehistory. And why we emphasize prehistory was that the old village middens are rich in faunal materials. So we can prove that the Aleuts were using sea otters 4,000 years ago. And we can prove that they were using three kinds of albatross 4,000 years ago. You can't do that anywhere else in the world. So there are the actual faunal remains, the bones of the seals, the sea lions, the sea otters, the fur seals, whales, porpoises, birds, and all the rest. And therefore, we get some idea of the diversity of species and the proportions of the members of the different species by digging them up. We know that they were using sea urchins 4,000 years ago. We know that they were using tufted puffins and shearwaters. It's there. That's hard evidence. Nobody can contest it. So part of the ecosystem, then, we get by excavating. That's why we suggested and discussed a section on prehistory, as well as on humans. I put humans first. They're more important than the animals. But if there aren't some animals, there won't be any humans. And then I think the third section that we discussed was the division of natural resources. And what we came up with was a suggestion that there should be a negotiation and a joint management system with the Department of Interior and other federal agencies, rather than a fighting contest. So they work out a system of joint management. And I think this was I think the Aleut Corporation is more astute than several other corporations. They want results. I don't care whether they win or not, as long as they come out ahead. I think this is why. So these studies do contribute to an ecosystem approach. I think you use just the right word. See, there are systematic relations between the humans and the animals and the plants and all the other resources. And it's our business to find out what those are and then to make use of them for the benefit of the people. So then that was taken back to a conference and then to a second meeting, and I think they came to a good result. It will be negotiated. So this has a very practical thing. One way in which these studies have had a practical effect is to simply prove Aleuts got here first and nobody else. That, and the skeletons are similar, the same as those of living people. And the dental characteristics and the size of the head and so forth. So you can prove that those are Aleut. They're not just people, they're Aleut people. And that's the basis for the land claim. You say, this is Aleut land, and it's not Eskimo land or Indian land or somebody else's land. But then you can go further, and you can point out that there were these systematic relations with these species of birds, animals, and fish present. And they were used, the people depended upon them. And it didn't kill them off. No species disappeared in 8,700 years. There wasn't any disappearing species, any endangered species, while the Aleuts had control.
I hope the outsiders don't get the impression that they can